You're listening to a Nerdy production.
Warning, this is a Nerdy production.
Welcome to the GM Workshop. My name is Jacob. In this series, I want to talk to game masters and game designers all over the world, because I want to explore game mastering and the different perspectives in tabletop role-playing game. Let's get started. Welcome to the GM Workshop. Today's topic is sci-fi, and with me on Discord, all the way from the US, is Crystal Tomanati, who are an expert GM, podcaster, and a huge sci-fi fan. But first, as always, I want to introduce Chris. And Chris, can you tell the listeners where you come from role-playing-wise and where you landed now and anything there between?
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here, and I'm honored to be considered an expert GM. I like that.
We'll see.
I've been playing for a while. I started in my sophomore year in high school, which over here in the U.S. is our second of 4 years in high school. Had some friends that were playing Dungeons and Dragons. This was back when third edition had just come out. And they were meeting at a local game shop. They invited me to join, and it was a huge group. There was like 8 or 9 people. It was really overwhelming.
Oh my
god. It was crazy. And they had a private room in the back, like a separate room that we could close the door, which was kind of cool. And there's a couple, maybe 4 or 5 high school kids, and then everybody else was like young adults between like 20 and 30. And eventually most of the kids from high school that I knew kind of fell away from it or dropped out, and we met every Wednesday night. And when that campaign came to an end, because I kind of jumped in halfway, the GM invited me to play in their next game. He was like, you know, you're a little bit more mature than the rest of the crowd. He's like, I'd love to have you. And, you know, of course, being whatever, 12, 13, I was like, oh, wow, that's awesome. So that's how I first got into it. Ran my first D&D campaign for that group maybe about a year later. So I learned a lot of my initial stuff from my first GM at the time. And did tons of D&D throughout the years. So that was primarily what I played, third and then fourth edition. And then I've dabbled in a lot of other things, GURPS, Warhammer 40K, especially the Fantasy Flight line and the new Wrath and Glory. A little bit of second and third edition Warhammer Fantasy. A lot of fourth edition, the new one that came out. Alien, that's my big passion right now, along with Warhammer. And the role-playing game Dread, which uses a Jenga tower instead of dice. That's fantastic. So just lots of different games over the years. And I've pretty much since those days in high school, I've had at least one RPG group that's met weekly. You know, the games and the people have changed, but I still play with a lot of my old friends. And I've done a lot of public stuff, too, over the last 2-3 years, you know, running games at Gen Con, for Gen Con Online, did a little bit of game design, and I worked for Games Workshop for almost 8 years, starting in my last year of high school. So throughout like the 2000s, I was at GW, and I worked at like 6 or 7 stores out here around Chicago. I was a manager my last year before they, just before 8th edition, Warhammer Fantasy was about to drop. So I've been playing with toy soldiers and RPGs and video games, man, since since I can remember. So, a lot of stuff.
Oops, you're dead.
Tell us about your first great experience in the role as a game master. And how was it? And why was it so great?
Sure. So, luckily, my very first time being a DM was a good one. It was a positive one. So while I was playing with that group back in high school, my first group, we started with a D&D game that I jumped halfway in. We finished that, and then we jumped over the same GM that was running the game, Dave. He switched over to GURPS, and we did a sci-fi setting that it felt a little bit like 40K in some of the story aspects. But it had a lot of weird, crazy stuff. There were like space vampires and mutants and just all sorts of crazy stuff. So we did that. And as we were doing that, I started writing my own game for D&D. And as we were coming to a close, you know, the GM was like, okay, what are we going to do next? And I took him aside. I said, hey, Dave, you know, I've been working on a game. I'd like to run it. And I said, you know, I'd like to run it for you guys because I feel comfortable. I've been playing with you guys for over a year now, and you guys are all really experienced. So I'd love to have the feedback as we play. And he's like, dude, that's awesome. He's like, I'm down. And so when the game came to an end, his game, we talked about it and everybody was on board. So I was very lucky because I had a group of people that were very supportive right off the bat.
Yeah.
And all of them being more experienced than me, that really helped boost my confidence. So I had written my own kind of game in like your typical fantasy D&D setting, just my own world, my own ideas. And I really started by drawing a map and starting to name some of the kingdoms and cities that were in this place. Borrowed a lot from things I knew back then, like Warcraft and Diablo were big inspirations back then. You know, Warcraft 2 and 3 were out, and Diablo 2 was in its main, you know, main days. So I borrowed a lot from that. And, you know, I created like a main NPC, which is like the king of the kingdom. And it focused on the story of his capital city and kind of like his journey going from being like a king, thrust into leadership at a really young age, like a teenager. And then all the struggles that his kingdom went through, trying to be a good ruler, trying to be a good neighbor to the other kingdoms around there. And eventually it delved into this huge meta plot of going through different, you know, planes of existence. The planar handbook back then for D&D was out. I really thought that was cool. So ultimately, you know, they unlock all these ancient portals and they start plane jumping. And ultimately the campaign was supposed to end with them fighting the god Vecna. And you know, that was kind of the big confrontation. I've ran the campaign a couple times and never quite got to the end. Usually by the time I got to the plane jumping, it kind of fell apart. But yeah, for the beginning, it was good stuff. So I was very fortunate. Everybody was supportive. Everybody really enjoyed it, and everybody encouraged me, which was really helpful. Yeah, so that was. I was lucky there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to have experienced players that want to give you feedback and try to help you on the way, not only when the campaign is ended, but also through the campaign evaluations and so on, right?
Yeah.
When you evolved, if you could say that, from Dungeons and Dragons and in more into games where hero-ness was less explicit than in Dungeons and Dragons, what was it that made you take that step from the heroism and the impro fantasy worlds, as you said, you just drew a map, to a more confined setting like one roleplay or Aliens later? What was it that made you take that step from away from DMing to DMing?
Sure. So I think a big part of it was my time at Games Workshop. Yeah. I worked for them for, as I said, about 8 years. And eventually I was exposed to Warhammer Fantasy RPG, which at the time was second edition, is what was currently out. And one of my friends,
hashtag Ratcatcher,
hell yeah, small vicious dog.
Yeah.
one of my friends that I met through Games Workshop, one of my customers who became a good friend of mine, he ran a game and we played, and then I dabbled with running a game as well. And you know, fantasy is one of my absolute favorite settings. You know, the Warhammer fantasy setting. I've known that game inside and out. You know, I've read every army book since fifth edition. So. I've been playing the game since I was like 10. So I love that setting. And so an RPG that was set in there, you know, it really started to change my perception that like everything wasn't just about D&D. Like I knew there were other role-playing games out there. You know, our store had rows and rows of books, but that's all that really the group I played with really played. So I started delving into that and I was like, you know, this is really cool. Like I can play like an Empire soldier or Skaven or a Chaos Warrior. Like that kind of blew my mind a little bit. So that was the first delve away from classic D&D.
Yeah.
And eventually that led into some of the 40K RPGs as well, which at the time was the Fantasy Flight line. So we did a little bit of Rogue Trader, and then we also did some Black Crusade. And, you know, those, you played a couple other things too, like Iron Kingdoms from Privateer Press. I had a friend run the, I think it's called the Witchfire Trilogy.
Yeah.
It's like kind of a big story they have. Yes. So It was nice, you know, one, to finally have someone else GM, because I had been game mastering for most of that time with my groups. And, you know, unfortunately, though, when a lot of times when someone else GM'd, they were running D&D.
Mm.
Because no one else really knew a lot of those other systems. So part of it was getting bored of just classic high fantasy. I wanted to branch out and try some other things. And, you know, playing in some of those universes that I knew really inside and out, like Warhammer and 40K, that really drew me. So that's kind of where it all started, branching out from just classic Dungeons & Dragons.
That's epic.
When you sit down with a player group, let's see, next Friday, you want to start a new campaign. What do you bring to the table with your group? Do you have it all ready to go? Do you have a pre-constructed campaign? Do you have a blank canvas? Do you have anything? How do you start? How do you start the first step in a campaign with your group?
So I would say, especially nowadays, you know, I've never actually had a true session zero in any of my campaigns up to this point. Because it's always been, we decide to play a game, and 9 times out of 10, I was the GM. But even if I wasn't, whoever was the GM already had an idea. They were either going to run a pre-gen campaign module, or they already had a story kind of in mind. So it was like, hey, we're going to play this. Let's try this mission or this adventure, and we'll go from there. And for myself, usually when I jump to a new system, I like to run a pre-gen module first, just so that there's less for me to prep, and I can try to get my head around, okay, this is what the creators of the game kind of envision a typical session being. So then I have an idea, like, okay, here's how difficult things should be. Here's how the flow of the game should be. Is, you know, what's the balance between role-playing and combat and investigation, stuff like that? What are some of the themes? So I find that pre-gen's really helpful for that. So that's what I did when I first ran Rogue Trader. I looked through some of the pre-gen adventures. I found one that seemed exciting that I think everybody would be kind of cool and enjoy. And then when we did Black Crusade, same thing. My friend who ran the game, he started with a pre-gen, which then bled into a homebrew after we finished some of the pre-gen stuff. So that's usually where I start, is with a pre-gen, and then go from there. And I've always got different ideas in my head.
Yeah, I think it's a great point you got, because game designers have been much better designing the opening campaign setting or scenarios or mini campaign or whatever when designing the game. Back in the days, it was just games, but now they are really showing us how to use the system. That's often pretty easy, but still how to tell the story in the system, how the designers eventually want to use the system's parameters. I'm rarely playing the pre-cons, but I often use as a foundation for my own stuff. It's very knowledgeable, very, very good way to link in a new setting or new system. But you mentioned session zero, and in horror, some triggers could come into play. Do you have any thoughts about triggers and session zero and warning labels for your players? Are that any safety mechanisms? Do you have anything in store for those?
Yeah, you know, I think especially in this day and age, things have changed a lot, you know, over the last 10, 20 years,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
So I think people have to be a bit more mindful and conscious of that. It's been a bit of adjustment for me, because I've, over the last year or two, I've started doing, you know, GMing for random and public groups, especially for Gen Con and Gen Con Online. So I've never really had a problem with like hanging out with new people. You know, I mean, when I worked for Games Workshop, my job was to run strangers through a demo game and get them into the hobby, right? So that's not an issue. And I'm very good at explaining rules in a way that someone understands. They're not just totally overwhelmed. You know, you try to explain a game like Warhammer Fantasy to a new player in all its detail, you know, they're going to look at you like a deer in headlights. So you got to break it down and make it manageable. So, you know, that I'm fine with. As far as like triggers and things like that, you know, up until my more recent public stuff, you know, my group, there's nothing, never even a conversation, because, you know, we're so used to hanging around each other. You know, we all know the types of things that we're into and things like that. So it's never had to really be an issue. But nowadays, especially now that I'm going to start doing more public stuff, you know, try to have that conversation up front. As a matter of fact, I've got a group that's looking to hire me as a GM, and we're going to do some Only War, the 40K RPG. And, you know, one of the first things I asked them was, you know, what do you guys want out of this game? What kind of things as far as subject matter? Is there anything that I need to avoid or anything that you guys don't want in there? And, you know, you got to just be upfront and honest so that you don't accidentally step on something that somebody might, you know, consider offensive or be, you know, afraid of or uncomfortable with. So they were like, yeah, you know, we don't want any like extreme sexual violence. Gore and that kind of stuff is fine. And they're like, you know, if there's torture, that's okay. We're probably not going to partake in it, but we understand it's 40K, so it might happen. So you don't have to avoid it, but we don't need it. You know, it's not necessary. So luckily they were really easy with their stuff. And yeah, it's easy enough to adjust to.
Yeah, if there's a lot of tools out there to, like, in Call of Divinity Lost, I love to play. They have these horror contracts. They want to. I always use this for my players to have some no goes, and there's some other tools with red, yellow, and green lights on scenes. And as you said, with torture, there's a tool like fade to black, so you could set the players are watching this torture scene, and you just fade to black next scene. So the players can imagine what they want, but still you haven't told them what to expect. That's some different tools I dabble in and yep. Try to balance between them. But the best way is the way you are doing it. It's be open, talk to the players, and if you want to press players on issues that might be difficult for them, but not scary or they have to be scary, but they not cross the border from scary and pressured to I will stop the play, stop the game. Right, that's it's the fine balance things, because the immersion is much more cooler and great, especially in horror games, when you can make feel the pressure as a player, not only at the character but also the player behind the role. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you use sandbox ray rolling? We're all using both, but on this axis, where do you find yourself and how much do you use it and where do you use it in the story?
I think there's a good place for both of those in an RPG. You know, sometimes it's got to be tailored to your group. You know, some groups don't want a railroad experience. Other groups don't care. They might want something more, you know, open-ended. So just, you know, that's part of it, is kind of reading your group and knowing what they want. You know, luckily with some of my personal groups, that's never been a huge issue. I mean, people understand if you're going to be running a pre-gen module that there's probably going to be some railroadiness to it. But I've always been conscious to change things that I think are weird or don't make sense or, you know, kind of dumb. So to make for a more fun experience there. I think most of the time it's a good discussion to have and, you know, let players know up front, you know, this is what it's going to be like. And, you know, if we need to change that or alternate, let me know. I don't really have a preference. You know, I've played in both and I've GM'd both, and I think there's a place for both of them.
Yeah.
And in pretty much all my experiences, even with a pre-gen, there's always been a mix of it. It's never been one completely over the other. So
no,
that's never really been an issue.
When we talk about sci-fi, especially, it's very very easy to railroad the players, and it's very difficult, in my experience, to let them sandbox. Because it's often in a space station or a colonial space station or a spaceship or something, so they are confined to a very geographical small area, and that's sometimes the issue to make room for sandboxing in those small confinements. Do you have any tools or experience with this?
Yeah, I think one of the best things I think a GM can try to do is really get prepared as much as you can, but get into the idea and accept the fact that you're going to have to improvise. And the more comfortable I think that someone can get with that, I think that's one of the best tools a GM can master, you know. And it can be tricky, especially when you're new. You know, somebody throws do a curveball. You know, you've planned X, Y, and Z, and all of a sudden somebody's like, well, I'm going to try this. And maybe it's, you didn't even consider, this, you know, I didn't consider there'd be a fire extinguisher in this room, or I didn't even think the player might have had a ladder or a rope. And I think part of that is you got to have players let their agency and let them try things, even if it's ridiculous, rather than saying outright no. Stress that, you know, this is going to be tough, it's going to be tricky, but sure, I'll let you make the roll and, you know, apply a modifier if need be. I think, you know, a good group of players will always respect the GM's rulings, even if it's not something they necessarily agree with, and talk about it later. And I was kind of brought up with a lot of my first people that I played with. You know, the GM's word is law. It's his game, it's his world, or her world. So, you know, if they tell you it can't work or it's not going to work, you got to accept it and go around it rather than having an argument. So, I think part of it's letting players be good at adapting. Just try to be prepared, you know, try to think of weird situations, you know, put yourself in that situation. Like, okay, if the GM told me here's what's going on, what would I try to do? And, you know, if you can come up with some weird, crazy stuff, that'll help you when players eventually do that. Because any GM will tell you that no plan ever survives contact with the players.
Nope.
So you just gotta think on your toes a lot.
Are you sure you want to do that?
Improvisation is it's a great tool and a necessary skill to have as a GM, because if you want to have a game running smoothly, players always want to fuck things up for you, and you have to be on your toes and know where to improvise and where to prepare. In sci-fi especially, I think it's problematic to see improvisation as the only option.
Yeah, no, that
because
that makes total
we have
sense.
To prepare, we have to know science, we have to know the limits of the spaceship. We can't just improvise a new room or new engine thingy. And I like to put a time frame on my players. I like to pressure them. I like to make it intense. And this is railroading in some aspect, because they just can't sit down and drink coffee in the mess hall. And I have to make them understand that they are under pressure. There's a time frame. There is some danger they have to handle in this moment. And but how do you think in player agency in the whole respect of the game, and where railroading and improvisation are connected in a smooth game status?
You know, it's funny that you bring up you know, like letting how much to let a player do and how much freedom. And you know, thinking about it, I think that I think in sci-fi in particular, it can be a lot more difficult for a GM, because you have technology. And I found that when player characters have access to technology, it can sometimes trivialize a situation, or they might ask something that you as a GM never considered, and you as a person don't really know what the answer would be, because you're talking about something that doesn't exist. And I found that could be really tricky as a GM, especially, you know, I've been doing a lot of Alien lately, and as much as I know about that universe and then the Alien lore and everything, well, somebody asked me, oh, if I hack into a computer, can I figure out X, Y, and Z? And sometimes you don't know what the answer is, like in game, like, oh, I don't know. That's never been addressed in any of the films or any of the media that I've read. So you have to make a ruling on that. So that can sometimes be tricky. And I think it becomes more of an issue in sci-fi settings, you know, especially if it's a high tech sci-fi setting, you know, like, I guess to some degree, like Star Trek, Star Trek or Star Wars, you know, they're so vast and there's so much there. I mean, you can't know everything. So you got to be prepared to make a decision on some of those things.
We are continuing our theme on genre and sci-fi. So Christopher wants to enlighten us and give us some perspective on this genre. Follow us on our Facebook page and group, GM Workshop, the podcast. We really want to interact with you. And if you want to talk with us on the podcast, write to us and we will create the frameworks for such a talk.
No, you won't get any XP.
Okay, today's topic is genre and part of our big theme we have on the podcast is the main focus here. And one of the genres we want to talk about is sci-fi, especially hard sci-fi. To define hard sci-fi, it's where we don't have weird races or not as many weird races, no space magic. If these components or elements are, they are well-defined and are part of a more dark setting, like in Dark Heresy or Warhammer 40k. But we will focus on primarily settings in this talk where space magic and weird races are not so typical. So Chris, when you will create your next campaign in sci-fi, what is the most important element for you, if you can sum it up?
I think I would say right now it's probably horror. I'm a big horror fan, especially for movies and things like that. And, you know, obviously I've been drawn to the Alien RPG because of that. And I'm a big fan of those movies. You know, I started watching Aliens back when I was, still in grade school, you know, probably like 8 or 9. And, you know, when I found out there was a movie before that called Alien, it just blew my mind. And the system and the game really... its strength is playing into horror, and I haven't done a lot of that in my role playing before. It's always been kind of action focused. It's always been story driven. I've always focused on character stories and the overall plot, but horror has been something I haven't had a chance to delve into too much. So it's a nice change of pace, because that's my personal preference.
That's pretty cool. So if you want to create a campaign, to sum it up, you want to focus on the darkness in space, in spaceship floating around in mid-space, the cold corridors and so on. Try to give your players a readiness for this is not going to be a happy My Little Pony story. It's got to be dark. It's got to be probably bloody as well in some terms. But still, you want to use the sci-fi feel of spaceships and or colonies or... And take inspiration from the original movies. The new movies are, they are okay. But
famous last words.
Try to capture some of those elements from the original movies. When you're working with this setting, let's take in sci-fi as a general. Which parts of a campaign or a scenario are difficult for you to embrace?
Sure. Yeah, that's. I would say that's a huge one, and the other one is if you are playing in a sci-fi setting that has, as you put it, space magic. You know, if you've got the Force from Star Wars or the powers from Mass Effect, which by the way, Mass Effect I absolutely love. I wish there was a real RPG for that game, an official one.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
Those can really trivialize things. You know, when I've played in a couple Star Wars games, and 9 times out of 10, every situation is solved by the Jedi. And it's like, you know, as cool as that is, it also becomes really boring and stagnant. And it's like, well, why would I ever play anything other than a Jedi? It's just this Swiss Army knife of solutions.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, with technology, you know, part of it comes, I think, from knowing the setting. You know, like I personally would never want to run a Star Wars or a Star Trek setting because I'm not as ingrained in those universes. I don't know the lore as much. I don't know how some of the technology works. You know, that wouldn't be my strong suits. I'd struggle if a player was getting really crafty with some of those things, you know, a droid hacking something, or, you know, C-3PO can speak a million languages. Like, I wouldn't be prepared for that. That would be tough for me to deal with. So in something like Alien or in 40K, because I'm more familiar with those settings, I have a better idea of how it works. It's easier to come up with a solution that the players can kind of accept at face value when you explain it, and they don't start to pick it apart. And at some point, everyone has to, you know, kind of suspend their belief and just be like, okay, we're playing a game here and we're getting a little too into the weeds with the details, you know? And usually that only happens if you have a player who is like, you know, actually does something like that for a living. You've got like an engineer or, you know, someone who's into construction or, you know, an astrophysicist, something like that. You know,
biochemistry.
Yeah. If you had, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson at your table, you know, and you're trying to explain a black hole, he might be like, that's not how it actually works, you know? So luckily in my experience, those players are few and far in between, but, you know, luck, most of the time, you know, players that I've had, you know, even if it doesn't make sense, they're okay with just kind of nodding and going along with it for the sake of the story in the game. So,
yeah,
it can be tricky.
The classic, like, blah, 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 technology work like this, and so on. it's fine. Do you have any issues with the preconception of sci-fi when you with your players, especially if you drew in new players, and what the technology level are in your game? Because if we look at Aliens, it's a game, or the movie, are the sci-fi elements in Aliens are catapulted into the future, but the movies are made in the 80s and some 90s, right? So the technology is catapulted from there into the future, but they haven't taken account like something like a cell phone. It doesn't really exist in that universe, and Wi-Fi. If you have to log onto a computer in a station, you have to do it with a cable and so on, because that was the future in the 80s. Do you have any problems with the preconception of where technology level is with your players? Have you any issue with that, or do you have any tools to help GMs talk about this?
Yeah, I often find that if I have players that are not familiar with the lore in the universe, I usually always ask, you know, anyone who's in my game, have you seen any of the films, whether it's Alien or whether it's Prometheus, you know, because even within Alien itself, the universe, you look at Prometheus and Covenant, which are supposed to be prequels, and the technology there is far more advanced than the other films, which take place later on. And that can be really confusing, yeah. Especially if you're not familiar with the setting. And, you know, a lot of that you can kind of explain because, you know, it was Peter Whalen himself that was involved, and this was, you know, the most technologically advanced ship because of what they were doing. So, you know, you can kind of explain, like, this is the exception. This is not the norm, you know?
Yeah. So I probably want to ignore the movie in this regard.
Yeah.
Just to uphold the illusion and the coherence of the rest of the setting. But how do you make the right preconception for the players in the setting's tech level?
I found, especially if I have players that are unfamiliar with the particular setting I'm in, I found having a discussion beforehand and kind of explaining some of those things can help set expectations. And in most of my experiences, when I do that, players are usually pretty good about asking, like, is this something possible that I can attempt, or does this technology even exist if I wanted to do X, Y, or Z? So, you know, most of the time I don't have players trying to just kind of do whatever. You know, they're usually pretty respectful about asking, you know, is this something I can even attempt, or, you know, can you explain if I want to accomplish this, is there a way for me to do that? And then I can maybe give them an in-game suggestion for how they might accomplish what they're trying to do.
When I want to introduce the technology level in my games, I often use NPCs to make it clear what is possible for the players to set the tone and set the acknowledgement of what the tech level in this issue are. For example, the cable into the colony mainframe is not Wi-Fi, and so on. We have to bring a cable, and so on. So the players know what the tech level in that part of a small corner of the technology is. So they have an idea how to play from it. The many questions in game will always stagnate the immersion from me as a GM, and for the other players especially, if there are too many off-game questions about technology. So how do you navigate with those tools to make sure the immersion stays on track and there's not that off-game talks about X, Y, Z technology issues? How do you manage that at a table?
Well, NPCs is a great way. A lot of my games, I'll have an NPC as part of the group, as, you know, basically a player character NPC. And, you know, that's kind of like my hidden seed where I can help. I can have that NPC kind of help direct the party if they're getting confused or lost or they're not sure what to do. You know, have them drop a subtle suggestion. And that's a good way you can, through the NPC, they can kind of help explain, you know, some of the lore and some of the setting in an in-game way that the players and their characters kind of comprehend and make sense. You know, I've never really had it become too much of an issue where there's been like technical questions left and right. But another thing that I found, another trick is good descriptions. And, you know, pre-gens are great for this because they'll give you, you know, little text blurbs that you can read to. And my groups, especially my personal friends, you know, we kind of have a funny enjoyment out of that. Like we'll kind of laugh when it's going to come up because sometimes it's kind of cheesy, but at the same time, most of us really enjoy it too, because again, you can kind of see from the perspective of the writers and the game designers, you know, here's what we envision and here's some things there. So I would encourage a GM, especially if you're new, you know, lean into that stuff and use it. It's there for a reason. And, you know, most characters, they really dig when you start really delving into some of that and you have a little fluff monologue that can really help them. And it might be presented in a way that's better than how you might try to explain it on your own. And I still use that, even for my homebrew stuff. I might borrow something or read something and then kind of rewrite it myself. And rather than just doing it off the top of my head, I'll literally be reading it line for line. And when you get enough practice with that and you get good with it and comfortable with it, you can easily slip it in and your players have no idea that you're reading from a script, so to speak.
In Alien RPG, the cards, do you have the cards when you play?
The initiative cards?
Yeah, initiative cards and the equipment cards and so on.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't played in person because Alien came out during the pandemic. So all my experience so far have been online, but yeah, I do. I mean, I give them the handouts in the game, so they have the digital version of the card.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
Yeah, we definitely use those too.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah. In Denmark, we are very lucky in terms of COVID. So we were down like a few months and then we were back up again. So,
oh yeah. So, it's a disaster over here in the States. Don't even get me started there.
So Chris, why is this this genre so great at role playing, and why do you love gaming in this genre?
Well, just like with a fantasy setting, I think one of the strengths of sci-fi is that it's something that we're not currently experiencing, or it's something we can jump into something that we don't have an ability to actually experience for ourselves in real life, you know. Very few people have had a chance to be on a spaceship and go out into space, walk on the moon, go on a space station. So just that ability to leave a planet and go through space is a really, I think, exciting thing that I think most people would agree. Even if they wouldn't want to do it themselves, they'd like to see what's out there, you know, even if it was just from a camera or a picture. So just like in a fantasy setting, you can go, you know, hang out with dragons and wizards or in a castle and see what medieval life is like. You know, in sci-fi, you can go fly through space, get in a spacesuit, walk on a zero gravity planet or, you know, space station. So I think that's a strength that leads it to being fun role-playing. It's different, it's unique, and it's something you can't experience in an everyday, you know, real-life situation.
So the exploration part of the sci-fi genre is what that drives it for you in terms of creating a game and make it fun. But also, I like this genre if you hold on to the hard science part of this genre, like Aliens and Mothership and the Expanse role-play. There is a mortality and a realness to this part of the genres that I love a lot and make it more, as you said, it's more escapism than immersion. If I understand you correctly,
yeah, absolutely.
Because I love the escapism, because that's why we are here. We are playing role playing. Like, but the balance between escapism and immersion is easier for me in this genre, because we are playing humans. We are not playing Twi'leks or whatever, or Klingons or whatever. We are playing humans. We know how it feels to walk on a cold floor with our bare feet. We know how to eat. We know how to get ASIC and so on. We have a lot of tools to make a sci-fi game more evocative and more immersive than fantasy genre, in my experience. Do you have any of these elements with you when you play this game, let's say Aliens? Do you take your time to talk to the players around the more very basic things in inner being human?
Yes, especially when I start a game or if I start a campaign, I think it's very important to try to set that expectation and set the setting of just how insignificant a single human is in the grand scheme of the galaxy or the universe. You're in a massive, cold, empty ship that could probably fit thousands of people, but a crew of 20, you know, something like that. Lots of machinery. And, you know, Alien in particular, you've got, you know, a lot of your tech is big and boxy and clunky. And because it was made in the 80s and the 70s, it looks that way. So I think that's really helpful, because if a player comes across, let's say, like a computer terminal, and you describe it like the way it is in Alien versus, let's say, in Star Trek, you know, that can instantly set the idea of, you know, this is dark, it's gritty, it's, you know, it's, I guess it's more, what's the term? Practical.
Yeah.
You know, it's not fantastic. It's just, it's a big computer on a spaceship versus, you know,
it's more
specific. Yeah, it's not just a hologram. Yeah, there you go.
Commodore 64 than iPhone, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Black screen, green letters.
Yep, big blocky text.
Yeah, for sure. And the funny part is Aliens might not be the best sci-fi setting in terms of technology and where we are now and where we came from, but it's great. And the Expanse TV show gives some pretty good ideas what sci-fi is, and the setting and system Eclipse Phase, where we evolve into traveling through the mind to places and 3D print anything we need. It's harder to immerse into this understanding of sci-fi, and especially in Eclipse Phase. So therefore, I think Aliens might be a better choice if you want to play this genre.
Well, there's a red button.
Which tools are great for sci-fi game, and which tools do you take from other genres and adapt them into a sci-fi skin?
I think part of it with sci-fi, it'll come down to which universe I'm playing in. If I'm an Alien, horror is always at the top of the list of what I want there, and also exploration and just the fear of the unknown and the mystery of learning some of these secrets of what might be out there. I think 40K has that to some degree because the universe is so vast and, you know, they're ever expanding the edges, but, you know, 40K is much more about things that are fairly well defined. You know, we know about the Eldar and the Tyranids and the Orc and the Tau, whereas an Alien, you don't know much about what's out there. You don't know a whole lot about the Xenomorph. You don't know a whole lot about the engineers in particular. So I think that scope and that the grandness of exploring and like the wonder of what's out there and the mystery of that is something I try to focus on. You know, and it can be tricky with Alien because for anyone who's seen the films, everybody knows when you describe an alien egg or a facehugger, everybody knows what's going to happen. So part of that, the players have to get in the mindset of like, your character is seeing something they've never experienced before. And in my experience, most players are very good at playing into that. And even though we are all screaming like, it's a facehugger, don't go near it, the player character has no idea. And they're like, oh, what's this spider looking thing? And, you know, it helps the dread, but you also have to bring in things the players aren't expecting. And if you do that, or if you're general, I think in your descriptions, you know, they might instantly think, okay, he's describing the alien, but maybe there's something a little bit different about it. That's not quite what I'm expecting from the movies. So you know, when you do that, I think that helps, because even though, you know, it's a xenomorph, they don't necessarily know what type of xenomorph it is. You know, especially if you dig into something like the comics or some of the extended universe stuff, you know, oh, it's a bull alien or the gorilla alien or the snake alien. They're like, okay, well, I know it's a xenomorph, but I don't know exactly what it's going to do. So you can still surprise your players if you get creative or do enough digging.
For sure. Tomorrow I am creating a podcast on metagaming, and metagaming as a use the player's knowledge in as a GM and exploit the knowledge, so you can screw with the players on the backside of the player's meta knowledge and what they know in a concept. Like I have played a Call of Divinity Lost campaign where the players are entering a Proud Boys military complex. All my players are not Trump fans as per se. And so they have a preconception that these guys are bad guys, but they actually need the help from these guys and they are not that bad guy at all. So that was pretty fun to turn around the expectations from the meta knowledge that the players had. You have to screw with the players in so well-defined setting as Aliens or 40K if you want to surprise them, and if the exploration part of the story or the campaign are still a possibility, because you can also stop the exploration at that it's more political or more character driven or something else. If you want to have the exploration part of sci-fi, you have to surprise your players and screw with your players' meta knowledge and expectations. In my interview with Rook last week, he had a great analogy about have to play your character as you just stole a car and are racing away from the police. Because in the first Alien movie, if they saw the eggs in the cave and just said, whoa, that's not good, we are leaving, then the story would never evolve. You have to embrace the understanding of the story's premise, and from there the players has to take responsibility into the story and embrace and ignore meta knowledge.
I've found that I've ran Chariot of the Gods a couple times for various groups, and anybody who's seen any sci-fi movie with any sort of aliens, you know, everyone expects, like, I shouldn't take my suit off until I explore this place thoroughly, right? And the very first group I ran through that became kind of an issue because, you know, part of that, spoilers here if you haven't played it, but, you know, there's a chance players can get infected by some of the fungus that's growing on the ship and might start to mutate. And if they keep their suits on, you know, in theory, they should be okay. And, you know, as a GM, you don't want to force that on a player. Even if they're not doing it to be metagaming, they're doing it because, okay, it makes sense. Like, we're on an unexplored place. We're trying to be safe. We've got a science officer telling us we have to follow procedure. Okay, that all makes sense in game. And, you know, why would any of your characters be stupid enough to take off your helmet, right? But at the same time, you have to push them in that direction. So working with things like their air supply running out, or they cut their suit on something, or something like that, there's some sort of malfunction where maybe they're going to be forced to do that, or they're in a time crunch, you can at least amp up the tension and the terror. So even if the possibility of them getting exposed is not going to happen, they're constantly under the pressure of, if I don't do X, Y, and Z, I might get exposed. And even if there's nothing in the air to infect them, just the thought that they've built in their mind, like, if I take off my helmet, I could die or get infected, that could be enough to make it interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Orange Chariot of the Gods is a great module, and I love the intensity of danger in module isn't the classic alien xenomorph. It's a disease. And but when I ran the module, I made the players false security. They took off their suits, and there wasn't any concerns from the players. Putting the players into a false security is one of my tools, and letting them know that they are safe and they are secure and they are cuddly, and then suddenly they are not, and hells break loose. Which tropes or tools are you actively avoiding in your games?
You know, I can't really think of anything that I don't use or that I avoid, unless it's something like a space magic type thing. But again, that's based on the setting you're in, and that's not an issue in Alien. You know, obviously horror is a big one. You know, even comedy sometimes can be helpful. You know, most of those movies, someone might crack a joke or two. You know, we've got Hudson screaming "Game Over," you know, things like that. So that can be helpful to break some tension and then maybe start to create a false sense of security for people. Yeah, I don't really think there's any that I avoid. You know, horror, exploration, tension, you know, fear of the unknown, exploration. Those are the things I like to try to focus on and bring to life, and you know, try to make my players feel like they're really there.
I love to use tropes and put the players' meta knowledge into play and make them and screw with the players on account of their meta knowledge. And especially in Aliens, as you said, with the alien egg and the facehugger, but also use the tropes in the mother AI on the ships, and the androids should always be like a unknown force or antagonist in some way, and twist that perception from the players. Android's super helpy, like in Bishop in the second movie. Screws with the expectations surrounding the meta knowledge and the tropes, and that's pretty cool. In horror, we have to step on the brakes in some occasions, and one of the most obvious examples in the Aliens franchise is the scene where Newt and Ripley are sleeping. It's a calm, fine, relaxing scene, and then they wake and the facehugger is free in the room. It wouldn't work as effectively if we didn't see Newt and Ripley lay down on the bed and sleep. It's necessary to give players some breaks, some calmness, and let up the horror, because they will create a hardness and the horror are not very effective from that out on.
There's a talent for Marine characters called banter, where if you take a rest, you know, they're basically telling jokes and stuff like that. And I always make players role play that if they say they're going to use it. I'm like, okay, what do you say to the group? Try to break the tension. And that can be really funny and enjoyable when someone comes up with a really stupid, corny joke that's just really cringeworthy. And for a moment, everybody's like, oh, we're just people trying to survive. And we have a brief moment of respite before we go back to the terror that we find ourselves
The
trapped
players
in.
has to use the role-playing parts of their skills or their abilities, the traits they call, right? Yeah. As a game master, we all love to tell stories, and we all have our favorite system, setting, or universe to tell these stories in. Christopher, we want to talk about the Alien setting and system, published by Freiliga.
Roll for initiative.
In this segment, Christopher wants to talk about the Alien setting and system. It's published by Freiliga. It's one of my favorite systems. In the first part of the segment, we want to talk about the system and why it's cool for sci-fi and the Aliens roleplay. And the second part of the segment, we want to talk about the Aliens settings and how to roleplay and how to use all the tropes and flavor and the fluff from these iconic movies and the franchise as a whole. So, Christopher, what is so great about this system, and why is it your choice of system in this genre?
Well, I think credit is definitely due to Free League here for making a very easy to understand game. One of the strengths of Alien, and I understand this is primarily the Year Zero engine, is that it is so simple. I can explain almost every rule in the game to players within like 10 to 15 minutes. I can give them a one-page reference sheet that has 90% of the rules on it and be like, here's how the game works. So you know, I think that's a testament to their game design philosophy. You don't need a super crunchy game to make something that's fun and enjoyable. Not there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I play Warhammer Fantasy, and that's a pretty crunchy game. So, you know, but that's what I love about it is anybody can understand it. You know, you've got two sets of dice, sixes are good, ones are bad. That's pretty much the gist of it. So, and you only have four attributes. You've only got, what, 12 skills in the game. So, yeah, I think that's something that makes it easy. So that rather than getting lost in the weeds of rules, you can focus on your story and on what's going on in the game and your players' conflicts and things like that. So that's always helpful. You know, they don't need to know how critical damage works right away to get going. You know, that comes up later. So, or how, you know, suffocation from no atmosphere works. You know, that's beyond them. They don't need to know that.
And the system is basically we have X dices contributing to a role, and those dices are based on your basic attribute and the skill you're using. And those two together are the dice pool you're rolling, and sixes are successes. But the cool part with the system is that you don't need a six to succeed. It will just take you longer time to open the door or crack the computer or so on outside combat, because in combat you have to have sixes to succeed to hit, but that's the only rule outside the rule. And the stress dices, Chris, please tell the listeners why this is so cool.
Yeah, so Alien's unique mechanic is its stress mechanic, which is meant to replicate the fact that you're a person going through a stressful, terrifying situation, and as it gets worse and worse, it becomes more of a problem. So as you encounter or experience terrible things, or you suffer effects from the panic table, your stress level goes up, and for every point of stress that you have, you roll another d6 of a different color whenever you make any check. So it's good because you can potentially have more dice, which means you have more chances of getting sixes, getting more successes. But if any of your stress dice come up as a one, your character has to roll on the panic table, and it's a chart between 1 and 15. And once you get past 10 and higher, you lose some player agency and you're kind of forced to do whatever the panic chart says. So your character screams, you know, out of fear, or they try to hide or seek cover or run away or just completely break down and kind of have a mental episode. So it's really helpful because as a player, you can very easily just look at your character sheet and see, okay, I'm at 3 stress, I'm at 4 stress, and all of us can very easily fit, you know, see, okay, I've got a 1 in 6 chance of rolling a 1, I'm rolling 6 dice, odds are I'm going to roll at least 1. So it's easy for players to grasp, even if they're not gamers, you know, just generic, regular old people can figure it out. And as a gamer, you can understand because you know the odds fairly straight up, and so you know whether you want to push a roll and, you know, be risky, take more stress at the expense of getting a reroll. And you have an idea like, man, you know, people become scared to make rolls or to do anything, not even just crazy, but just to try to do anything because they don't want to fail and get caught in a situation where they're stuck. It's a good mechanic, and it really captures the feel of this game. You know, just like corruption points in other systems or insanity points, things like that. So I think just by having that mechanic and explaining it to your players, they're going to have an idea what they're in store for.
Sure. I love that the stress mechanic is a meta currency as well as it's a game mechanic must use from the players. I love that concept because we have a reroll option as a player,
yeah,
but it still costs you and has an effect directly into your role as you use it. And I love that mechanic, that the meta currency, that is a normal thing in newer games in all regards. In this game, it's slot into the core of the game and in a much more comprehensive way than other games I have experienced.
Well, that's a failure.
One of my problems with the stress mechanic as a whole is the frustration from the players. Have you met this frustration or?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I've got one friend in particular. He doesn't really enjoy the Alien RPG because of that. He doesn't like losing player agency, which I understand. And I think part of it is you have to be upfront with your players when you start. You have to explain to them, you know, I'm very, very clear with players, and I tell them, you know, once you get past four stress, you're going to start failing rolls, and you're going to lose control of what you're doing. So I always stress, like, it's important to try to manage your stress here. And you don't want them taking rests every 5 minutes, because that'll break the flow and the tension of the game. But you also don't want it to just devolve into something where 2 hours into the game, the whole group is dead. You know, that might not necessarily be exciting. So you got to let them take rests, but if you make them feel like even though they're resting, they're not safe.
Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe the rest gets interrupted, so they only get rid of some of their stress. Or even if they do get rid of all their stress, especially if you have somebody with the banter talent, because that just clears stress so quickly. You know, sure, okay, everybody was at 6 stress, now they're down to 0. That can very easily ramp up again in this system, especially with, like, the cascading effects that can happen with panic. You know, all of a sudden, I took a panic test. Everybody else gains a point of stress. And, you know, it gets around to your turn. You're like, I started this combat with 0 stress. I'm up to 3 and I haven't yet taken my turn yet. So,
As you said, Chris, in combat or in stressful situation, the players get a culmination of a lot of stress points from other players and other characters.
Yeah.
And suddenly you have 4 or 5 stress levels that your character didn't have before, even before the scene started, and that can create a lot of tension and a lot of frustration from players. And losing this player agency is one of the key problems with this mechanic. So you have to manage it as a game master and know what and how to help the players understand and cope with this frustration. One of my house rules is that my players, they can choose not to have any more than 3 levels of stress in their stress dice pool. They can choose to have more if they have more stress, but we cap it at 3 dice, so the players have a chance to succeed and don't get affected as much.
Yeah.
It works, and I tried it a lot of times in different groups with different players. So
2 things that I've done on occasion. One of them is even if they do roll a 10 or higher on their panic, to still let their roll succeed, depending on what they're doing. If it's going to be good for the story, and this is true in any role-playing game, no matter what you're playing, if you're the GM, it's okay to break the rules if it's going to make the story and the scene better. Whether it's you're rolling behind a GM screen and you're flubbing a roll, or it's just something you let a player go through with, despite what they're trying to do, they may have failed, there's still some success there. If it makes the tension better and it moves the story along, it, you know, 9 times out of 10, I've never had a player in all my years be like, why did you do that?
For sure.
You know, they've always been like, oh, that was so cool that X, Y, or Z happened. So that's one thing is, depending on, even if they quote unquote fail because the rules say they do, they can still succeed and then they panic. And so you can have the best of both worlds there. That's one thing that I found is really helpful.
yeah, for sure. Yeah, because it's very, very, the mortality and the intensity in this system helps lobbing into the story in Aliens and as it should, because I love the non-crunchiness in the system. It's much easier to have an intense action scene, the runaway scene, whatever, when you have a system that doesn't need you to roll to look up books after books after books of what kind of rule in what situation. So that's one of the clear strengths, and one of the things I love about this system is the non-crunchiness with the system. Okay, the setting, Chris. Why is this such a great sci-fi setting and a role-playing setting for you?
Well, I think part of it is, you know, Alien was one of the first big franchises out there that set the bar for sci-fi and sci-fi horror in particular. Obviously, there's older things like 2001 Space Odyssey and things like that. But for me in particular, this was the first real sci-fi that I was introduced to alongside Star Wars. And obviously those are two very different beasts.
Oh, yes.
So it's something that I personally enjoy, you know, from my personal perspective. And you know, it's such a huge franchise. You know, you mentioned Aliens. Just about everybody knows, and they think of the Xenomorph, the Facehugger, and Ripley. So yeah. Bringing it to new players is very easy because most people have seen at least one film, so they have some expectations there. You know, it doesn't necessarily require a ton of explanation on your behalf, whereas if you're playing something more generic like Mothership or something like D&D, you know, you might have to explain a little bit more about the world and the rules and the lore and things like that. So from that aspect, that's really helpful. And for me, because I've grown to enjoy darker, grittier games recently, I'm very over the heroicness of games like D&D, and I want the threat of death and injury to be constant in my games and a reality. You know, it's very hard to die in D&D. It's even harder to have a party wipe.
Yeah.
And even if that happens, there's ways to come back to life, you know, depending where you are and your power levels. So that's what I like about darker, gritty games. You know, it's more interesting to me that there needs to be consequences with your failures. And, you know, that's why I focus. So
yeah, the mortality helps immersion for sure. My experience is that's the key word for me when I'm playing role playing. I want to have my players immersive in their character and know that the choices they do has consequences.
Mm-hmm. As you said. Yeah.
Chris, how do you work with metanology in this setting? It's very defined, it's iconic, and our players want to have aliens delivered when we play aliens, but we also like to surprise the players and give them some horror elements. Because if you see an alien egg, as we talked about before, they know, okay, the jig is up, there's aliens, there's a facehugger, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you use this setting and still surprise your players and still give players who knows this iconic setting inside and out a great horror experience within the confines of the setting?
Yeah, so it's definitely an issue with Alien because it's such a well-known franchise. There's no way around that. You know, if you were playing Mothership, you know, it's what you make it, so players don't know what to expect. But obviously with Alien, that's going to happen. I think some strengths, especially with Chariot of the Gods, because that focuses on the black goo, and Prometheus and Covenant are in some regards are not as popular as the original films. So I think that's helpful using that because everyone's expecting a xenomorph to show up, and instead you have people mutating and these weird abominations running around, and the Deacon alien, which is still like the xenomorph, but it's a little bit different. So that's one thing that's helpful. I think a good way to combat that is, you know, maybe have a discussion at the start of the game of what to expect. That, you know, look, we all know what a facehugger is, and you may or may not encounter that, but you always want to keep the players guessing. I find sometimes keeping your explanations and your descriptions vague can help. You know, there's always the idea that don't just draw me a picture of Cthulhu. Let me draw it with my own mind, because that'll be way more scary than whatever you put on paper. So when you start to describe something, the players might have an expectation. This is what you're describing. And even if that is what they're expecting, there might be little subtle details that they're coming up with that you don't mention. So rather than, like in Chariot of the Gods, you find a vial of the black goo, you find a vial with some strange dark substance. You don't even say black, because as soon as you say black, they probably know what you're talking about. You say dark substance, it leaves a little leeway, like, is it the black goo or is it something different? So just carefully subverting those. You know, when I describe a facehugger, you know, you don't ever use facehugger. You know,
that's a trope.
It's a pale, flesh-colored, spider-like creature. It's got legs like long, extended fingers with fingernails on it. It's got a segmented tail. You know, you say things like that, and they have an idea, But they might still be thinking, is this mm-hmm. a facehugger, or is it something a little different?
Sure.
So, you know, and I think a typical person, unless they're a big fanboy, they don't have all the knowledge of everything in Alien. So they might be, like, preparing themselves mentally, like, okay, well, it's probably a xenomorph, but it's maybe something that I'm not terribly familiar with. So, I would say the biggest thing is keep your descriptions subtle and somewhat vague, and let the player's imagination run away with it.
I always try to use the show-don't-tell mechanic or the concept. It's important for me to let the player's imagination run away with them in the story and let them try to define how they see the scene. The alien acid blood on the floorboards and, as you said, the facehugger. Describe it, don't say it's a facehugger. Let the players imagine how to see the creature or the scene, so it becomes more scary. In the Cold Divinity Lost, there's a mythology about a veil between the real world and our world, like in Matrix. And I often use this in a scene if a player see a creature and let them explain how horrific this adorable little secretary is when it's changed into the real creature this secretary is, and make the player explain how horrific this creature is. I don't explain it as a GM, but the player explain it.
That's brilliant, man. I'm going to steal that one for sure.
Sure. Okay. But it's just a tool to make the game more immersive for all the players, and especially the one player that is targeted out by you as a GM can put some perspective and some storytelling into the story. Mm-hmm. All the players are getting more immersive into the scene. So, yeah. Do you have anything to say about the aliens and the alien setting?
You know, the only thing I think I would maybe point out or suggest, I definitely feel that Alien is strongest when playing in cinematic mode, because it's jumping right into the action, so to speak. So, for players who aren't familiar, they suggest you basically have campaign or cinematic. Campaign is typical. You've got a longer story, longer plot. Your characters gain experience. They can develop a little bit, and the mortality is not nearly as high, and the chances of encountering aliens are a little less intense. But in cinematic play, which has been most of what they've published so far, is meant to be like you're in Act 3 of the movie, so to speak, or you're right where the action picks up. And it's good for that because this system can be very deadly and fatal, and it's more exciting when you've got characters getting picked off left and right. And if the players do manage to survive for the most part till the end, it makes the players feel very triumphant that they somehow overcame everything. It doesn't happen too often in my experience, but the potential's there. So I myself have not run a campaign yet. I've only done the cinematic adventures, but I think the Colonial Marine campaign definitely plays more towards a campaign feel. And I've seen some other podcasts and other shows out there where, you know, if you do a campaign, it's more of a slow buildup. And, you know, they don't encounter the xenomorph in session one. It's something you lead up to. You explore the lore, maybe learn more about the political and corporate sabotage going on, or, you know, what are androids' place in the universe, you know, just dealing with other humans that are hostile, and then learning more about these mysteries that are out there in the universe. So if you're looking to play Alien, definitely make sure you know which of those you want to play and lean into that. And if you explain that to your players, I think it'll make for a much more rewarding experience. And the other thing too to point out, because I've had this become an issue with some groups, especially the pre-published things, there's a very high chance that there's going to be inter-party conflict. There's probably going to be PvP. Someone might be a traitor. They might try to kill the other players because of their agenda. So while you don't necessarily want to reveal that in the game, because you don't want to ruin that surprise, it's much better when players don't expect it. It's something to consider, because I have had one or two players, they've been very put off by that, and they don't enjoy the PvP of the game. And in my opinion, it's one of the strengths of Alien, and it's what makes this RPG cool, is that someone might be a traitor lurking amongst you. And, you know, it could suck, yeah, if all of a sudden the person you're working with, they pull a gun on you and they shoot you when your back is turned. But from a story perspective, it can be way more interesting. And especially with, like, hidden androids and things like that. And more of my experiences have been positive than negative, but I would caution any GMs, keep that in mind if you know you have players that aren't into inner party conflict, or if you have players that have a tough time separating in-game conflict from out-of-game conflict.
Yeah,
you know, that's something you got to be aware of, because, you know, most of my players, you know, I've had people do pretty despicable backstabby things, but everybody knows it's in the game and it's not personal, right? And one of my friends in particular, he always seems to end up being the bad guy in some of the Alien games just by random chance. Mm. You know, not like he picked his character or anything. I do things randomly. So he's kind of gained a reputation, like, don't trust Ben, right? But at the same time, like, it's from no fault of his own. So as everybody is good with that and they understand, like, you know, this is a part of this game, just to be aware for GMs, it could cause problems down the line. So approach that as you think you need to, but just be aware it could be an issue.
For sure, for sure. That's a good point, because we have the Aliens setting, and especially the short scenarios they published, have these mechanics of agendas and buddies and rivals and so on. So you have to be aware of this, and you have to explain to your players that the characters you have in front of you right now might not be the character you end the scenario with. That's another cool thing, because as we talked about before, play your characters as you just stole a car and want to get away from the police, because it drives the story through the scenario much more easy, and understand how the mortality and the effects of the choices your characters might lose their life, but so far, so what? Because it's a cool story. Take the responsibility as a player as well as a GM. And so what? My character dies, I get another one, and then I have another story and another agenda and another buddy and rival. Things, it might be hard for especially hardcore campaign players to understand this. I have some players that had a very hard time coping with this mechanic of high mortality means that I have to play another character in a moment and not be so attached to my character. And that's maybe one of the flaws in Aliens and the setting. The attachments and the immersion might fail a bit because, you know, the mortality is so high. It might be the player's issue and not really about the settings issue, in my experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think as a GM, you should let your players know, look, especially if you're playing one of the cinematics, you guys are probably going to die. Someone's going to die. There's backup characters. No one's going to be sitting on the sidelines for very long. And, you know, I'm going to make sure you're there almost up to the end in one way, shape, or form. But at the same time, yeah, I've had players that aren't into that. One of my best friends, he's not crazy about, you know, he wants to get invested in his character, which I understand. That's totally natural. That's fine. You know what? This might not be the game for you. And that's okay. You know, not everybody's into horror like I am. I totally get that. Some people want to play the epic stuff like, you know, like D&D. That's fine too. It's not my cup of tea. So as long as you let your players know, give it a try. If you think you might not like it, try it. Give it a taste. See if it's cool. If you don't like it, what have you lost? A couple hours of your time? No big deal. And, you know, you've experienced something new. But if it turns out it's something that you enjoy, or it's a different way at looking at an RPG or a game, you know, you never know. I mean, I might play a Star Wars campaign one day that I think is the coolest thing on earth. And I'll never say no. I'll definitely give it a try. You know, so you never know. Just give it a shot and see what happens.
And let it loose and go with the flow and just, okay, well, I have this short description of my character description, and let's fly with it. And then 10 minutes in the game, I got shot in the head by my rival. And so what? I got another character and I cope with it. And let's go. I think that's one of the strengths. But as you said, it's a difficulty for some players, and that's totally fine. Really enjoyed talking to you, and I thank you a lot for your time, and I really want to talk more with you, maybe in segment about the Dark Heresy or Warhammer Roleplay in some time. If you like.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it. And my wife has given me the stink eye over my shoulder here. So I'm like, hey, man, we're nerding out. I can't help it. So.
And last of all, and very important part, some commercial for your projects right now, Chris. What are you doing right now? And of course, I will charge you later, so don't worry.
Sure, yeah, I appreciate that. So, okay, yeah, so other people out there, you might recognize me as the Great Unclean One or Lord Borak in some of my other circles, but I have a channel called Dragon's Greed Gaming, which ultimately I want to make a channel about all things gaming, but with the working life as well. right now it's focusing on one actual play series called Gallows Geists. It's a Warhammer Fantasy 4th edition game. We've been playing for over a year now. We're up to episode 65. And it's a mix of some homebrew, mostly homebrew, but a couple pre-gens mixed in there as well. It follows a group of adventurers who are the warband of a witch hunter. And so it delves into much more of the dark, gritty, nasty things in the Warhammer world.
Nice.
And, you know, some of the trauma that comes with being exposed and constantly fighting chaos and undead and things like that. So you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Spreaker, anywhere you get a podcast, Apple Podcasts, things like that. We've got a YouTube channel as well. It's just audio, but if you'd rather have it playing in the background, that's a way to do it. And we've also got some alien stuff we've recorded. We just finished Destroyer of Worlds on Friday. So I've got that coming out eventually, some of my own stuff I've done. So we'll definitely have Alien in the future. And then we're going to be moving over to Wrath and Glory for Warhammer 40K when the fantasy campaign finishes up. So probably the next couple months once our fantasy campaign finishes up. And then you can also find me on Start Playing. I recently have started offering my services to GM. So if you're interested in horror and action or sci-fi or Warhammer and 40K or Alien in particular, that's definitely where my strengths lie. So shoot me a message if you're interested, you guys want to play, and I'll definitely be doing Gen Con online again, or hopefully in person next year.
Yeah, let's see how long the anti-vaxxers are holding you
together here with the COVID virus. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. Yeah, but failing that, I'll definitely be on Gen Con online as well. So, I got plenty of things. So check us out. We got a lot of cool stuff. Dragon's Greed Gaming.
So a lot of cool stuff, and I will link it all in our show notes when this episode launches, and link it on our Facebook and Discord, of course. Thank you for this, Chris, and I hope we talk soon again.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and thank you, Chris, for joining me today. We will continue our deep dive into the sci-fi genre, and next time it's all about cyberpunk. Follow us on Facebook, GM Workshop, the podcast. If you want to interact with us and talk to us, give us a message.